Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Neurology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team and two patients on the best practices to achieve early diagnosis and maintain the quality of life of adolescents and adults with later onset spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA. In this activity, an SMA specialist, a general neurologist, a physical therapist, and two adults living with SMA discuss how a multidisciplinary approach can tackle the key challenges in maintaining quality of life for patients with later onset SMA. We cover the clinical presentation and diagnosis and the transition from pediatric to adult healthcare services. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an independent educational grant from Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Novartis Gene Therapies Incorporated. In this podcast, an SMA specialist and a neurologist who specializes in adult neuromuscular disorders discuss the clinical presentation of later onset SMA and the processes for differential diagnosis.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name is Claudia Chiriboga. I'm professor of neurology and pediatrics at Columbia University Medical Center in New York and the pediatric MDA care director at my site. Today, I am joined by Dr. James Weimer, who is neurology and professor at the University of Florida in Gainesville and also the director of the Fexell Motor Neuron Center, which is a multidisciplinary clinic that follows ALS patients, SMA patients, and other motor neuron disorders. Today, we will be discussing the clinical presentation of later onset SMA in adolescents and adults and the process for making the diagnosis and differential diagnosis considerations. We know that there is a delay in diagnosis with SMA, but it's more obvious in the younger child who has trouble walking because the process proceeds faster. But in older onset SMA, it can be years before it is diagnosed. Case in point, I followed a woman who, in adolescence, her mother thought she was lazy because she had trouble running and became fatigued. And it wasn't until she was in college that she couldn't climb a hill and realized that there was a problem. So there is a big delay, and it's something that should be considered. Oftentimes, there will be orthopedic considerations because of the manner of walking, there can be intorsion of the leg, and the patient results refer to orthopedics. But let's talk about specifics of the gait. And the gait is a proximal weakness, and the differential diagnosis is of other pelvic girdle disorders that we need to consider. And let's take, for example, a 15-year-old girl who sees her primary care physician and is complaining of feeling very tired when she's walking. At the end of the day, she feels tired. Sometimes her legs will give out and she will fall. When she has repetitive activities with her arms, she fatigues. She's trying to build muscle strength because she's not very muscular at the gym and she is getting nowhere with that activity. So in the differential diagnosis, we would have pelvic girdle weakness of a neuromuscular disorder. So what is helpful will be the reflexes, which should be diminished, but early on they may not be. You would get the CK that may be elevated even in SMA. I found in more of the more active patients, especially someone who's at the gym, that the CK can be somewhat elevated, 500 or 600 and even more. So how do we make the diagnosis and make the differential diagnosis? Well, you can suspect it clinically and order a genetic testing, but sometimes it's not clear. So you will want to do an EMG and see if you can identify if it's a myopathic or a neuropathic disorder, but sometimes the EMG can be normal in SMA type 3. So those are things to take into account, and that's when the genetic testing comes into account. The first thing that I would do, given how fast the SMA gene testing is done, is the SMN1 gene testing. And if that's negative, then I will proceed with a neuromuscular panel if we're not clear which direction to go. And my question to Dr. Weimer is, how does it present in older patients? And if you could give us an example.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Chiriboga, because I actually love the example you gave as the first patient that you presented during the introduction, because that's for adults that can be such a typical presentation that we can see that the patients will, in an adult, or as you mentioned, even in this 15-year-old, people will think they're just lazy. You mentioned the patients that will be going to the gym and they'll be exercising to try and improve themselves, because the SMA patients are normal otherwise. They're cognitively, they're perfect. They go on and get degrees. So they feel this weakness, they understand it, and they work hard to improve it. So a lot of them, especially the older adults, will be people who are exercising, but just can't quite keep up with others. And that way that you were describing it was perfect for how we're going to see in somebody who's older. You know, our case two is more of a 40-year-old gentleman, but this could be a 20 or 30-year-old gentleman who's presenting, or patient rather, I should say, a 20 or 30-year-old patient that's coming in with this increasing difficulty tripping, walking. There may be bulbar, but as you pointed out, like in the 15-year-old, there may not be. They just may have difficulty, you know, when they're playing softball, running the diamond, and they're just not keeping up, and they're trying to figure out why. And that's what led them to their primary care provider, who then led them to the neurologist. And what we have to do, as when we're seeing neurologists, as you said perfectly, is we're trying to sort out, is this a muscle disease? Is this a nerve disease? Where are we headed? Is it proximal? Is it distal? What involvement? ALS becomes in the differential, especially as they get older, but the ALS patients usually have more rapid, they'll talk about a year or two in their onset of it, as opposed to the SMA patients, who are going to talk about this lifelong, as you mentioned, in the 15-year-old is going to do it. And that's when we start getting that history of the nerve, we start that it's neuropathic, and the EMG supports it, that I agree, absolutely. That's when we start saying, let's do the genetic testing. And in this day and age, it's easy to get the genetic testing to sort that out, because identifying that helps us so much with treatment.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more about the ease and the speed with which we can obtain an SMA gene testing, the SMN1, and make a diagnosis, because then we can start offering them treatment, which we didn't have to offer before. And it's a wonderful situation to be, because we now have options to treat, and it's important to diagnose them as quickly as possible and to think SMA, even though they might not look like SMA, what people typically think of what SMA looks like. There's a paper by Lynn that says there's a 4-year delay in diagnosing SMA type 3, but that's all comers. In the adult SMA onset, this later onset, it is much longer. We're talking 5-10 years sometimes of symptoms before somebody realizes that that's the issue. Perhaps it would be helpful if you would give your most salient features that make you suspect SMA in a patient, that they come through the door, you hear the history, you examine them, and you say, this more likely than not is SMA. Let me check for that, rather than another of the limb girdle weaknesses.
Yeah, and thank you. That's a really good question, because so many of the patients will present, especially the later adults that are presenting to their primary care or their neurologist, with just a gradually progressive weakness. We will say that's one thing about the SMA. It'll be the gradually progressive. But we will hear about the weakness without a lot of sensory changes, number one, to argue against a neuropathy type of process and more towards a motor neuron or muscle process. And then we look at the pattern of that weakness and the involvement. And do we think it's primarily muscular where we're seeing the fatigue of weakness, or is it this motor neuron process that we're referring to? When we get to the question for adults where we're trying to sort out ALS, one of the bigger concerns is going to be the presence of upper motor neuron changes. So if we get spasticity, brisk reflexes, not fatigue-related cramps, but just random cramps that could be signs of that spasticity, that's going to be a little bit of a red flag that it's not an SMA. But if we don't hear that, it leans us towards that lower motor neuron. And then we also have to include the inflammatory neuropathies, the multifocal motor neuropathy, which as it gets more advanced, it can have a stepwise course, but it can appear symmetric. It's going to be a little more length dependent. It's not going to have the bulbar that SMA would have, but it can be an overlapping syndrome that will come with that. How will we sort those out? Well, as Dr. Cheruboga mentioned earlier, in all of our patients, I think you're absolutely right. It's the EMG plays a major role in deciding, are we going forward with that? But the EMG is an extension of the exam. As you pointed out, you can still, in a type 3 or 4, get a pretty close to a normal EMG. But a normal EMG will help you with excluding the ALS diagnosis, the multifocal motor neuropathy diagnosis. So it's putting these pieces together. And that's why I think we both would agree, if we're headed down that road, you need to refer to a multidisciplinary center that sees these patients.
Right. And it's not dissimilar in adolescents, in young adults, which I do treat. I think from the gait is quite different. Let's compare the muscular dystrophies from SMA. Typically, there's more hip weakness and Trendelenburg gait, where the hip falls, whereas it's more of a waddling gait with the muscular dystrophy patients. I think fatigue is much more impressive in SMA, and it's part of the phenotype, the fact that at the end of the day, they really are wiped out, which you don't really see so much with muscular dystrophy. And then the CK is very helpful when it's very elevated and it's not so helpful, or it's normal, which would make you think more likely than not that it is SMA. But again, with the milder limb girdle dystrophies, it may not be very elevated. So that might be tough to manage just on CK alone. But everything else that you've described, and I think CIDP is another thing in younger children that might present with pelvic girdle weakness and might be a little more chronic, but it's a lot faster, as you were talking with ALS, that it's weeks, not years, that you deal with that kind of pelvic girdle weakness. Well, it is time to come to a close, and I wish to thank the faculty and the audience for watching, especially Dr. Weimer, for this lively conversation. And you can find out more about the management of patients with later onset SMA in the other short videos in this activity. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Neurology at www.touchneurology.com. Don't forget, there are two other chapters in this series. These will give you further insights on this topic from the multidisciplinary team.